It's Curtain Call. I'm Charles Sipos. Welcome to today's program. In the first of three segments today, I'll be speaking with co-director Wu Han about music at Menlo's 12th season around Dvorak, July 18th through August 29th, actually August 9th, in Menlo Park and Atherton. In the second segment, I'll be speaking with shakuhachi grandmaster Riley Lee, who previews his performance with Taik Oz, the Australian preeminent Japanese toko drumming ensemble, Friday evening in-person theater, Sonoma State University. In the final segment, I'll be speaking with prodigy playwright, director, and actor Desi Gallegos and company about Hamlet's Orphans, a penetrating play for adults created and performed by kids about what it's like being a kid, July 18th through 27th at the Studio Theater, 6th Street Playhouse.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Israeli military is still trying to shield its major cities from the barrage of rocket attacks out of Gaza, more than 500 during the last few days, and the death toll from Israeli strikes on Hamas targets in Gaza continues to climb. Gaza's health ministry is reporting more than 100 people killed since clashes intensified 4 days ago. Both sides are under pressure to cease fire. The UN raised concerns, though, that Israel might have violated international law that prohibits the targeting of civilians. The Israeli government defends its airstrikes and is pledging not to cave into international pressure, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu put it earlier today. President Obama's $3.7 billion request to cope with thousands of unaccompanied children crossing the southern border is moving in the democratically controlled Senate, but so far it's stalled in the Republican House. NPR's Esfi Date reports it is not likely to make much progress there next week either.
Incoming Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy says House leaders appreciate the seriousness of the problem and that both the Republican Working Group and the Appropriations Committee are studying Obama's request.
The Appropriations Committee is currently reviewing the president's request for a supplemental, but I do not anticipate that coming up next week. But as we look towards the remainder of July, we'll keep you posted.
Appropriations Chairman Hal Rogers told reporters he thought the $3.7 billion figure was too high and that he hopes to have a better idea of the problem by next week's meeting of the Republican caucus. Congress has 3 work weeks left before its planned August recess. Esfi Date, NPR News, the Capitol.
The White House is projecting less of a deficit than initially thought as the economy continues to improve. Today it announced a 2014 U.S. deficit will likely be closer to 3.4% of the gross domestic product rather than 3.7% as projected back in March. Cleveland basketball fans are welcoming back LeBron James, who has agreed to return to the Cavaliers this fall. For member station WKSU, Kabir Bhatia has the latest.
Ever since LeBron and the Miami Heat lost the NBA Finals in June, speculation has run rampant that James would return to the Cavs. He led Cleveland to several playoff berths before bolting for the Heat in 2010, but always maintained a presence in his nearby hometown, Akron. High school junior Seth Hutchman, keeping watch outside of James's suburban mansion, says the soon-to-be Cavalier is the best basketball player of all time.
I think he's just as good as Jordan, or at least he will be when he's done with his career. He's so much more athletic and stronger and just does everything better than everybody else in the NBA.
Several NBA teams were also awaiting James's announcement to decide how to proceed with clearing cap space and signing other players, including James's now former Heat teammates, Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. For NPR News, I'm Kabir Bhatia in Akron, Ohio.
U.S. stocks trading slightly higher, with the Dow gaining 11 points. It's at 16,927. NASDAQ is up 16 points. S&P 500 up 1. This is NPR News.
Thank you.
We're listening to the last movement of César Franck's Piano Quintet from last year's Music at Menlo. This is one of those box set recordings that they do live every single year. It's called Music at Menlo Live. This one is Music at Menlo Live 2013. The whole series last year was called From Bach. This year's is called Around Dvorak. It's the 12th season of Music at Menlo, and the co-directors are Wu Han and David Finkel, and David Finkel is with me by phone to talk about this year's festival. Hi, David.
How are you?
Great.
Thank you for inviting me to talk.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's always a great pleasure having you on, and it's always a great pleasure talking about Music at Menlo, which is one of the absolute finest chamber music festivals on the planet.
Well, thank you for that.
as evidenced by what we just heard, the precision and the musicality of that music making is just stunning.
Well, we work very hard, not only, of course, on our performances and rehearsals, but also on these recordings, which are done as carefully as anyone can imagine.
I wanted to give the website before we even start. It's musicatmenlo.org, and at is spelled out, musicatmenlo.org. So you can follow along, because what we're talking about today is the whole season, and it can be kind of complex as because there are a lot of things going on in the season, as always. So maybe let's talk about it a piece at a time. Let's talk about, actually, before we do that, it's called Around Dvorak this season. So why Around Dvorak, and what's happening around Dvorak?
Okay, well, you know, I have to say that when I was a younger musician, and not even much younger than I am now, I didn't really have an awareness of how intellectually broad and diverse Dvorak's thinking was, his experience. And I came to realize rather slowly that Dvorak of the 19th century European composers was one of the most widely traveled, the most cosmopolitan in many ways, the most curious and the most easily embracing of new ideas and outside influences. I think because we love Dvorak so much, and we even love the way he looks, you know, with his scruffy little doggy style beard and of course this what is now an adjective, bohemian identity attached to him. We think of him as being kind of a peasant. But he really wasn't. I mean, he was heavily influenced by the great Viennese classicists. And he wrote a beautiful essay on the music of Schubert. If nobody's read that, you should, because it reveals in there that he knows not only all of Schubert's music, but like all of the other people's music as well. And he compares it very, very astute. The fact that he paid such tribute to his homeland through much of his music, but also came to places like America and embraced American native music. The fact that he was so highly respected by Johannes Brahms, the toughest of the classicists in the Romantic era. I mean, these all add up to an extraordinary figure, one with depth and dimension that maybe not all of us realize. So the Around Dvorak title implies that we're going to not only look at the music and listen to the music of Dvorak very intensively, but also check out his influences, his roots, his musical descendants, and everybody that was affected by his music in a very, very influential way. So that's what Around Dvorak is about, and I think if you follow the festival through with that kind of idea in mind, it all becomes simpler and makes a lot of sense.
We're talking about Music at Menlo now in its 12th season. The 12th season is called Around Dvorak. It runs from July 18th through August 9th, 2014. For more information, you can go to musicatmenlo.org. I'm speaking with David Finkel, who is co-director with Wu Han, of Music at Menlo, as well as Chamber Music at Lincoln Center. And now, David, I would like to talk about the concert series, which is maybe the core of Music at Menlo.
Yes. Okay, well, we have what we call our concert programs. They're not by any means all of the concerts that we play, but they are what we call our main concert programs. And they are, each one of them is kind of structured around a certain idea or a certain facet of our main theme. The first, you want me to go through them, Charles? I'm happy to.
Yeah, very briefly, because I want to try to cover each aspect of the festival if we can.
Of course. Well, our first program deals with it's kind of a broad picture of the Dvorak landscape. We have a work by Mozart, of course, his predecessor in time and in style. We have a work by Dvorak himself. But we also have 20th century works by Martinu and Béla Bartók, both heavily influenced by the folk idioms of Dvorak. So that will certainly put Dvorak in a context right away, a very, very broad context that we want to establish.
Yes.
Our second program, I'm actually on the website. Don't expect me to have all of these in my head.
Understood.
It is dealing pretty much with the Viennese, what we call Viennese roots. Dvorak was a real student of the classicists, and so the composers on this program are definitely heavily in Dvorak's mind. You know, the composers of the early days, they used to study the works of their predecessors intensively. I mean, you take a composer like Brahms, for example, was such a student of Bach. Dvorak, of course, looked to Mozart. He looked to Beethoven. He looked to these composers for guidance, for inspiration. And so this first program is dedicated to the idea of his taking from the past. Mm. And then let me see if I can. You know what my problem is here is that I'm working off a Mac computer, which I don't really know how to work very well.
Oh, okay.
So I'm very slow. Can you just tell me what the third program is?
Sure. Like, it's the Lobkowitz Legacy, and I do have it in front of me.
Ah, yes. Okay.
And I think this is a key program in the series.
Yes, it is. Well, it has to do with one of my favorite subjects, which is patronage. Without musical patrons, we would not have a lot of the music that we're privileged to enjoy now. So, yes, the Lobkowitz family, a Bohemian nobility stretching back 600 years, they were around for the artists of their times, especially the seventh prince, who lived during the time of Beethoven and Haydn. And Joseph Franz Maximilian Lobkowitz commissioned Beethoven. He commissioned Haydn, and he was a supporter and a concert presenter as well in both his palaces in Prague and also his place in Vienna. Among the works that he commissioned were Beethoven's Opus 18 string quartets, the first set of six quartets.
Amazing.
That Beethoven composed, and that we will pay tribute to in this concert, where we will hear one of those. He also commissioned Haydn's Opus 77 quartets, and we will hear one of those in this concert. They are commonly known as the Lobkowitz quartets. We will hear also the Beethoven Opus 74 quartet, commonly known as the Harp Quartet, which was also a Lobkowitz commission. And we'll also hear a marvelous Beethoven song cycle called An die ferne Geliebte, or To the Distant Beloved, which is arguably the first real song cycle in history, even preceding Schubert. So this is going to be a very interesting program. We will have the Danish String Quartet to play this program, and we will, moreover, we will have with us the current heir to the Bohemian Lobkowitz holdings and family. It is William Lobkowitz, a very enterprising young gentleman in his 50s, who by luck after the Velvet Revolution of 1989, inherited the entire Lobkowitz holdings in the Czech Republic.
So he will be
with us to tell the story, remarkable story of his family.
I want to lead into the encounters because I'm not sure we're going to have time to cover all the concerts. Suffice it to say, we got to concert program 3, and I believe there are 7 in the series.
Absolutely.
And just go online, go to musicatmenlo.org and see what the rest of the concerts are. But let this be a bridge to the Encounter series. And there are, I believe, 4 encounters, the second of which is a royal tradition. And it's led here by William Lobkowitz. And tell us how this is a bridge. So he's actually not only going to be there at his in his presence, but he's actually going to lead this encounter of yours.
Absolutely, yes. Well, the first thing he will do is to tell the story of his family, stretching back to the 1790s. But he is also going to tell the contemporary story of his family, which had to do with the family holdings having been confiscated in the 20th century twice, first by the Nazis, second by the communists, and actually having lost all of the holdings of the family all the way until 1989 when he was invited back to reclaim what was rightfully his. So that is an unbelievable story. And for the second part of William's encounter, we will be having musical excerpts from the time and place of this great Lobkowitz patron, and it's going to be very, very entertaining and very interesting.
If you want to know more about the Michael Steinberg Encounter series, you can go to musicatmenlo.org. So now, David, I'd like to talk about the Carte Blanche concerts.
Ah, yes. Okay. Tell me the first one.
The first one is Escher String Quartet. And we don't have time to do blow by blow here, however much I'd love to. But what I'd like to do is maybe take one as an example and let people know what it is a Carte Blanche concert is.
Well, a Carte Blanche literally means that the performers themselves do this programming. And we've selected, of course, artists that are so inventive and so filled with ideas. And the way it works is by project. The Escher String Quartet, for example, begins the series with the quartets of Alexander von Zemlinsky, one of the great late Romantic composers whose four string quartets are very, very underperformed. The Escher String Quartet has made a specialty of these quartets, has recorded them all, and we asked them to bring those quartets to our midst. Making his debut will be the great pianist Arnaldo Cohen, and we basically told him what our festival theme was, and he made a beautiful program, once again, around Dvorak of Brahms, Chopin, and Bach. So it goes on like that. Yura Lee, a fascinating young violinist who's been with us many years, has made a very, very extremely colorful, folk-oriented program. And the extraordinary pianist Gilles Van Sattel has done a program which is based on the idea of both folk music, revolution. It's a very exotic and wonderful program, which once again revolves around Dvorak.
One of the things that you do at Music at Menlo is a wonderful series of programs for and by young musicians. So would you tell us what these programs are for young musicians?
Yeah, well, we have what we call the Institute. The younger portion of the Institute is basically high school age music students, and then the upper part, which is called the international performers, is composed of conservatory age and post-conservatory very young professionals. They all perform a lot. The prelude performances that are before many of our events are done by the international performers. They happen pretty much before every single event. They are free to the public. And on the weekends, the young performers perform marathon concerts of chamber music on Saturday afternoons at the Menlo Atherton Performing Arts Center in front of a large audience, which is admitted free, but which must obtain tickets because the demand is now so high.
I'm speaking with David Finkel. He is co-director with Wuhan of Music at Menlo, along with chamber music at Lincoln Center. Music at Menlo, if you want more information, go to musicatmenlo.org. It's in its 12th season. It's called Around Dvorak this year. It runs from July 18th through August 9th in venues around Menlo Park and Atherton. Well, David, it's a great pleasure visiting with you. Give our best to Wuhan, and we're looking forward to seeing you at this year's Music at Menlo.
Thank you. I can't wait to get there.
You take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Once again, if you want more information about Music at Menlo, go to musicatmenlo.org. I'm Charles Sipos. It's Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa. Quintet by César Franck, and it's part of Music at Menlo Live 2013. That's the box set of practically all the music of Music at Menlo. They did that every year, and they're now in their 12th season. If you want more information about Music at Menlo, you can go to the website musicatmenlo.org. Everything's spelled out there, music, A-T-M-E-N-L-O. July 18th through August 9th. I'm Charles Sipos. It's Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa, and there's a program tonight at Sonoma State University and it promises to be an extraordinary one because it involves not only the Grandmaster Shakuhachi player who's with us here on Curtain Call today, Riley Lee, but the very auspicious Tyke Oz, Australia's preeminent Japanese taiko drumming ensemble. And so first I'd like to introduce Riley Lee, and he can introduce our other guests. Welcome, Riley.
Hello, Charles.
It's great to have you on again.
It's great to be back, as always.
Yeah. And so who have you brought with you from Tyke Oz?
Graham Hilgendorf and Anton Locke are two members of the Australian taiko group called Tyke Oz, which, of course, is a play on words, Oz being, of course, Australia, taiko. So taiko from Oz, the land of Oz.
I love it. So how did Tyke Oz come to be, gentlemen?
Well, it's funny me answering that question because Riley started the group off, actually, with our artistic director, Ian Cleworth, I think in 1997. Yeah.
Really?
And I think Ian was very keen. He'd studied taiko in Japan and spent some time with the group there and was very keen to get something going in Sydney. And I think with Riley's encouragement and enthusiasm. Ian started the group off, yeah, in 1997.
So not everybody knows what taiko drumming is, but some of those who don't know might have seen or heard of kodo drummers. So would you describe what taiko drumming is and how kodo relates to taiko?
Sure. It's a very good question, actually. So taiko drumming obviously comes from Japan. In fact, there's quite a large taiko drumming community in this area. And kodo has probably been praised as one of the most famous taiko groups. In fact, they've one of the groups that's quite inspired us. And in fact, I'd say that our sound has quite an Australian accent on top of that.
Really?
In fact...
Now, wait a minute. How can you have an Australian accent to taiko drumming?
Well, that's also a very good question. So like I said, taiko drumming comes from Japan. But when you look at Australia, Australia is an island. And everything we do in Australia, apart from indigenous culture, actually comes from another place. And so when you bring something to an island, such is the nature that things, I guess it's kind of like Chinese whispers, things get changed slightly. And whilst we always try and pay respect to our tradition and study the taiko as closely as possible, when we bring it back to our country, we can't help but, because we're not Japanese, so we can't help but put our own Australian accent on top of that.
I love it. Well, we're going to come back to that in just a minute. And I see you brought your instrument, so we're really looking forward to hearing that. But first, I want to come back to you, Riley, because I see you also brought your instrument with you. And is this actually a shakuhachi? Because this is different than the instruments I've seen before.
I've brought two instruments. My shakuhachi will be...
Oh, I see it over there now.
Yes, if we have time for two pieces.
All right.
Traditionally, the shakuhachi isn't used with taiko because the shakuhachi is a relatively soft instrument.
And taiko is a relatively loud
That's
sound.
Right.
Yes.
So typically, this other instrument that is blown, it looks like a fife. It's a bit like a little...
Okay. So it's kind of like fife and drum.
It is. It's
in the Western tradition.
Exactly, fife and drum. And it can cut through, because it's so high sounding, it can cut through the taiko.
Okay, could I have a short excerpt from that?
Okay, well, typically, it's not really a solo instrument. It's usually...
Oh, you're going to play with the guys?
Yeah, I will definitely play with them. I brought this as
well. Let's just hear a little bit of the sound of this instrument. Wow, it's even kind of scaled like a piccolo.
Well, it's up there high. It's very, it's got the same range as a piccolo.
And it's
for sure.
The same kind of mouthpieces. It's held. It's a transverse flute as opposed to blowing the end of it.
That's right. Yes. So it's a flute, isn't it? It's just a flute. It's with no keys or pads. Just a little piece of bamboo
and some holes.
And some holes. Yes.
Beautiful. Okay. So are you guys going to play together?
Yes,
sure.
We are.
Okay.
In fact, we're going to play a piece composed by Graham Hilgendorf. It has had many manifestations, originally called Chi, Earth, and then Graham developed it into Big Earth or Big Land, which is kind of a metaphor for not only Australia, of course, is big, but also all of the world. And we're doing a teeny tiny little version or segment of Daichi by Graham.
Okay, this is fantastic. And I have to say, these are big drums. These are like the equivalent of Western bass drums.
No, these are little ones.
Okay, these are the little ones of the set. Okay, well, we're looking forward to the rest. Okay, here we go. Thank you. Well, we're vibrating in the studio here. The power of this is really amazing, and putting these drums in a very small studio is really intense. Well, if you couldn't hear it, you could certainly feel it.
It's interesting you say that, Charles, because very often when we talk about Taiko, a performance of Taiko, we typically don't say, let's go listen to Taiko. There's two things we say. Let's go see the Taiko, because it's a visual thing.
It's a spectacle.
Yes, it is. And we have to use, the Taiko drummers have to use all of their body. It's related, for example, to martial arts. It's a very physical thing, more than just the rhythm. But also we say we go feel the drum. And the idea is that you feel it from the inside. Your entire body feels it. So even if someone, you know, totally deaf could still appreciate a Taiko performance, perhaps better than someone with hearing, because they can see it and they can feel it.
The preeminent percussion player on the planet is Evelyn Glennie, and she is profoundly deaf.
Well, so I'm told, yes.
Yeah. It's a really amazing thing. But I really get that. There's so much to what you feel in the presence of this kind of artistry. Talk about the spectacle of this, the costumes, and the sorts of things that you do besides playing, the martial art aspects of this and so on.
The performance that we're giving tonight has quite a great range of instruments and also movement, if you like. So not only sound, but movement. And in fact, I might get Anton to elaborate, but the second piece, so the concert starts actually with a very soft number with Riley and I, so we're exploring the softer sounds of the shakuhachi and the taiko together, and I perform that piece with Riley. I use soft mallets and doing rolls and all sorts of sort of soundscapes on the instrument, and then the next piece in fact is a very old dance tradition from Japan called Onikenbai, which translates as demon sword dancing. And the costumes are just incredible, and masks and all sorts of things. And in fact, Anton, it's good that he's here today in the studio, because he's studied this tradition a lot. So he might want to elaborate on the Onikenbai dance.
Before we do, I just want to send folks to the website. I'm going to give you several websites during the course of this interview. But this one is most appropriate to what we're talking about right now. You can go directly to the Taikaz website by going to taikaz.com. That's T-A-I-K-O-Z, taikaz.com. Okay, Anton, tell us about this tradition. I'm looking at a picture of a line of drummers, seven drummers. It's right here in front of me, but you can't see it, unfortunately. And there's a person who's in mid-air. it looks
that?
Like doing kind of a dance. I presume this is from your website, right?
Yes, it is from our website. In fact,
so
is that the dance that you're talking about? No, in fact, although the pose and the movements in the dance are very similar to that, the dance Graham was talking about is called Onikenbai, and in fact, you were mentioning martial arts earlier. A lot of the movements in Onikenbai are very martial arts-like, in the fact that you get very low to the ground, you use your legs, and you're also using the katana or samurai sword to clear the air of evil spirits. Huh? So this is part of the costume. You also use a fan, and you also have a mask and this big, long, like mane of horsehair that you flick with your head, and that's sort of the characteristics of that movement.
Ah, amazing.
It is.
Heritage tradition has a lot to do with Taiko and with shakuhachi, and we've heard some of this in your earlier visits, Riley.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested to get just a bit of the history and tradition of Taiko, how far it goes back, and how you carry on that tradition now.
Sure. Well, in fact, Onikenbai can be traced back 1,300 years. It's a 1,300-year-old tradition. And this is an example of what I was saying before about Taiko's Australian accent. What we like to do is, see, there's many different styles of Taiko. In fact, if you go to different towns in Japan, every town will have a different way or a different style of playing the Taiko. And we like to pick a few of those styles, and we like to go to those places, and we like to study them in depth, so that informs us when we come back to Australia of the tradition and keeping that cultural heritage alive and always paying respect to that. So in my case, I've been to Iwasaki, which is a place where Onikenbai comes from. And I've been there quite a number of occasions to study this dance, because when I come back to Australia, I want to do it as closely as I can to that. And I think that goes without saying that all the styles that Taikwaz plays and performs, we like to do that.
Riley, you were one of the originators of this group.
Mm-hmm.
And how have you, I should ask, how have you stayed involved, and how have you stayed involved, if you have, with the group over the years?
Well, I studied taiko in Japan with the group that eventually became Kodo. So I was one of the, in a sense, you could say, a founding member of Kodo back
really?
In 1973. And I joined as a shakuhachi player, but once you join, I didn't know, but you have to play taiko. So I did. I was forced to. And I'm glad I was, because it was a very valuable experience. And I never thought of myself as a taiko player, even though I did it on stage for a number of years with that group. Then Ian Cleworth, who Graham mentioned, wanted to start this group in 97, so he asked me to help him do that. We did. And in the beginning, I was playing along with everybody else, but I soon realized, particularly once Graham and the others started joining, that at first, you know, I knew more than anybody, but very, very soon everyone knew. Not only did they know more than me, but they were playing better than me, and the amount of time and effort that it would take me to continue to play taiko at their level, which was, you know, surpassing not only my level, but just about everybody else's level in the world, would require more time than I had. I'm not doing much taiko playing. In fact, recently I haven't been doing any, but I'm still very proud to be an integral part of the group. You know, they humor me and are very kind to me and let me hang on and play with them.
And we know that Riley can play the taiko if he's asked. he can step up and play as well as anyone else.
You will all be playing together tonight in the performance at Person Theater on Sonoma State University campus. If you want more information or want to get tickets, you can go to sonomamatsuri.com, SONOMAMATSURI.com. SONOMAMATSURI, sonomamatsuri.com. And there are, of course, tickets at the door. If you want to find out more about Riley Lee, you can go to his website, rileylee.net, R-I-L-E-Y-L-E-E, rileylee.net. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you all for being my guests on Curtain Call. Graham Hildendorf, welcome, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Charles.
Have a great performance tonight. And you too, Anton Locke.
Thank you.
And Riley Lee, always a great pleasure to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Charles.
We're going to go out now listening to some music from the Taikaz CD called Daichi Big Earth. This is called Kaigan Sen. We are listening to Tykoz. The CD is called Daichi, Big Earth, featuring Riley Lee on shakuhachi and bamboo piccolo. What is, in effect, bamboo piccolo? I'm not sure what the name of that instrument is. If you want to go see Riley Lee tonight, I understand that tickets are no longer available online, but they are available at the door. If you want more information, you can go to sonomamatsuri.com. Matsuri is M-A-T-S-U-R-I, sonomamatsuri.com. I want to be listening to this music, if we can, as I'm talking here. So Tykoz, they're appearing tonight at Person Theater, Sonoma State University. I'm not sure I have the performance time in front of me here. I don't. But if you want more information, go to sonomamatsuri.com, and that's where they have more information. It is Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa. I'm Charles Sipos, and with me this segment of Curtain Call is playwright, director, and actor Desi Gallegos. And he's here along with some of his company to talk about Hamlet's Orphans, a penetrating play for adults created and performed by kids, about, among other things, what it's like being a kid. From the Inside, July 18th through 27th, that's the Studio Theater of 6th Street Playhouse. Welcome, Desi.
Thank you so much for having us on the show.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. So you want to be about 4 inches from these mics.
All right.
So I think you're the elder of this clan. And yes. maybe the whole clan.
Yes, that's
indeed.
Right.
And you're all of 18?
Yes, I am 18.
Okay. So for those of you who haven't seen the articles in the Chronicle and I think maybe the Examiner mm-hmm. and maybe the Press Democrat, and there have been articles all over the place about Desi Gallegos and his activities. Right now you have a show running in San Francisco, right?
That's exactly right.
And that is what? Remind me of the title.
It's called God Fights the Plague.
Which I saw, and which is extraordinarily powerful. And that's a one-man show, right?
That's right.
Okay. This is not a one-man show.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us how you came up with this and how these young people have participated and are participating.
That's a great question. So God Fights the Plague is a documentary theater piece about religion. And I finished writing God Fights the Plague. And what fascinated me after that was morality. What does it mean to be a good person? What does being a good person look like? Sort of all facets about morality. And I read a lot about it on this past year where I've taken a year off between high school and college. And I had the idea that I wanted to create a show with kids where, so basically what Hamlet's Orphans is in April 2014, I got together with 18 kids aged 9 to 14, and we got together and we had discussions about morality, what it means to be a good person, what it is to be a kid. We had improvisations, we played games, and from these discussions, improvisations, and games, I went home and started to shape an original play. The play, Hamlet's Orphans, as you mentioned, is intended for adults. It's not intended for child audiences, even though the play is performed by the same 9 to 14-year-olds who helped write the show. So it's very intense. I'm as excited, if not more excited, for this project than anything I've done in the past. The kids I'm working with are absolutely incredible, so talented.
We're going to hear from some of them in just a minute. Let me ask you, are you on stage for this production?
I am not. I am the director and playwright for this one.
Okay. So also with us in studio are Giovanna Paulos. Am I saying
Poulos.
That right? Poulos?
Yes.
Okay. And Laura Sandoval?
Sandoval.
Sandoval, yeah. Okay. And Rennie Boyd, welcome.
Hello.
Okay. So what was it like creating this with Desi Gallegos? Like, how did you first come into the project, and then what did it look like? What did the project look like for you? Let's start with you, Rennie.
Well, how we got invited to Hamlet's Orphans was he called us and sent us emails asking us if we would like to join this project of his, and from my experience with Desi, of course, I said yes because he's awesome.
What is your experience with Desi? How do you know Desi?
Well, in Petaluma, there's a place called Cinnabar, which is a small theater where there are summer camps for kids, and I've been in quite a few plays in those summer camps, and Desi has worked there as an instructor and part director. And
So go on. I just wanted to get a context of how you knew Desi there.
Yeah, and so he invited us all out to this, and I said yes, and pretty much it's just we've talked a lot about morality once again with the discussions in classes, and it's just...
Among yourselves?
Yeah. Desi has asked us lots of questions, and we've answered them. And there have been very heated discussions in this. We have had people kind of fighting with each other sometimes about different opinions, but altogether it's been a great experience. I've grown a lot as an actor, and I just feel like I've grown a lot as a human being, too.
Wow. How about you, Laura? How did you come to this, and what has your experience been in the beginning stages of it?
Oh, well, I was invited from Desi because I was in Annie, and he directed Annie in the fall at Cinnabar Theater. And I came across this because he called me, and I feel like the process was good for outside of this show because he taught us to be that vulnerability is good, and we need that because... We need that for theater. And yeah, like Rennie said, I feel like we really grew because he had us thinking about thoughts outside of like our childish perspective. And yeah, I really grew in this process.
So Giovanna Poulos, Gio?
This is actually my first time working with Desi. I have done acting before at Sixth Street, so I got invited by directors there who know Desi. And for me, like Rennie was saying, we just started off sitting around together and Desi would give us prompt questions and we would discuss it and work off of each other's opinions, try to convince each other of different things. And then just from the character that we got from our discussions, it's just been amazing because it's like nothing I've ever done before. Yeah, it's really cool.
I'm going to come back to Desi in just a second. But before I do, let me just say that the play is called Hamlet's Orphans. It runs July 18th through 27th at the Studio Theater, 6th Street Playhouse. If you want to find out more as we talk about this, you can go to the website 6thstreetplayhouse.com. It's all letters except the very first character, which is the Arabic number 6, 6thstreetplayhouse.com. So Desi, how did you get the material for this play, Hamlet's Orphans, and how did you process it to get it to the stage?
So I came in with an idea of what I wanted the show to be like. I came in with an idea of the central story. The story I had in mind was it's about a young girl who is unable to feel empathy. She can watch the suffering of others and remain unperturbed, I think is the word I use. But the story follows her younger brother, who his entire life has cared so much about her and who basically at root really has wanted to fix her. What he's doing is he is writing a book of morality, a book on how to be a good person. And so the two of them enroll in a summer camp in the story at Sixth Street. And they enroll in a production of Hamlet. And in this camp, the young boy meets a young girl named Sophie, who is basically just a kid, just very innocent. And she begins to bring out who he really is, which is at root a child. But yet he keeps himself from being a kid for so much of the play because he's so obsessed with making his sister right, with writing this perfect book on how to be a good person. So a large part of the process of writing Hamlet's Orphans was for me to get together with these kids and say, let's write a book of morality. What rules would you put in a book on how to be a good person? And to get this perspective from kids, 9-year-olds who are in, fourth grade, but all the way to Gio, who just graduated eighth grade, this incredible age range, and to see what being a good person means to all of them was so exciting for me and so inspiring as I went to shape this play and to see what it looks like. Because in the play, this character, Rennie's character, James, gets the cast of Hamlet together to try and write this book.
Okay, so the whole thing is so fascinating, but the thing that keeps grabbing me is the image of this young girl who does not have empathy.
Right.
And that's like, it's really grabbing onto me. And where did you come up with that? Did you have a model in life, or was there a model in theater or film or something that?
That is a great question.
Where did that come from?
I had a friend who told me that she thought she was a sociopath at one point in my life. And I was absolutely fascinated by that, and I just wanted to know more about it. And that was really the beginning of the search, and now she says she's realized she's not a sociopath. And yet it sort of started this search where I read the book Confessions of a Sociopath by Emmy Thomas. I started reading about it because what I realized is we all have the ability to shut off our empathy. When we're angry at a person or saddened by something, we have the ability to shut off our empathy. But what would it look like if someone was actually deficient in some way? You know, people are born without arms, born without legs. What about somebody who's born without empathy? And so that's where the character came into my mind. She just stuck there. And what was more interesting to me, or what was as interesting to me, is what does the life of her brother look like? What is it like to be in a family with somebody who scares you and who you just want more than anything to make right? And it makes him into a very serious person. And we brought in some excerpts of the show that we can share with you if you'd like.
Let's do. Can you set it up?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So the first scene is happens between Rennie's character James and Laura's character Sophie. James and Sophie have just met, and they are Sophie has just stolen his book of morality that he's writing, and then the scene takes place.
Give that back. Give it back.
First, tell me what it's about.
It's a book of rules. You wouldn't understand.
Try me. I actually specialize in understanding.
Have you ever felt like you're destined to do something? Like your entire purpose in life was centered on one thing? Have you ever felt like that?
Once, I thought I was destined to be a princess.
I'm not talking about silly, childish dreams. I'm talking about something bigger than that. I don't know if I believe in fate or destiny, but I do believe this, that I am destined to write that book. It is my purpose. It is what I'm meant to do.
I could still be a princess. I could marry Prince George.
The baby?
Well, he won't be a baby forever.
You're like 10 years older than him.
My spirit animal is a cougar.
No one thinks about what I think about Sophie. No one worries about how we don't know, how none of us know.
Know what?
The rules of morality, what goodness really is. Sophie, there is evil in this world. Just because adults try to hide it from us doesn't mean it's not still there. It's inside of us. The monsters under our beds don't scare me half as much as the monsters in them.
Wow. These are strong words for such young people.
Yes. And that's been part of the joy of writing this project is Rennie's character, as you notice, James, is so intense and so above his years in so many ways. And it's just fascinating me to look at why that is. And why it is it's because he's been in a family where he's had to deal with so much.
Let me just say that was Laura Sandoval and Rennie Boyd reading that last segment. So do we have another segment? And is it fairly short?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yes.
Let's hear. I think that's maybe most telling.
Yeah, so...
So this next scene takes place between the girl who cannot feel empathy, Elion, and her younger brother, James. And Elion has just done something pretty horrible to one of the members of the cast, and James is confronting her about this.
How many lives are you going to ruin before you're satisfied?
I don't enjoy ruining lives, James. I enjoy getting what I want, and if that means ruining lives, then so be it.
When are you going to realize that some things are more important than what you want?
What could possibly be more important to me than what I want?
This book. Don't you have any desire to be a good person?
Plenty, but some desires are more important than that.
Like being cast as the king in a kid's production of Hamlet.
Like following through on what I say I'm going to do. I'd rather be selfish than a hypocrite.
So then you did frame him?
No, of course not. I set him up to fail and watched him do it. What's the crime in that?
Someday, Elion, everyone's gonna see you for what you are.
Well, that wouldn't be a very good day for anyone, would it? Have you given up on me, James?
No, of course not.
You make it sound like what I am is what I'll always be. Do you believe that?
Not if you follow the book. You have to promise me, Elion, when it's done, you'll follow it. I will stand up for you. I will protect you. I will keep them from taking you to doctors and asylums.
You think I belong in an asylum?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Listen to me. I will protect you, and all you have to do is follow the book. Please, promise me that you'll follow it once it's done.
I promise.
No, you need to swear. You need to swear on something that you care about.
I swear on my brother's life.
Whoa.
See, the scenes between Sophie and James and Eliana and James are so much different.
Very different. Well, this is an amazing play. We can tell already by these little snippets here in the studio. The play is Hamlet's Orphans. It is a play by a playwright, director, and actor, Desi Gallegos. He's playwright and director for this, and the material also came from the young people who are participating in this play. The play runs from July 18th through the 27th at Studio Theater, 6th Street Playhouse. If you want more information, go to 6thstreetplayhouse.com. I want to thank our guests, Desi Gallegos, Giovanna Poulos, Laura Sandoval, and Rennie Boyd. It's a great pleasure having you in the studio. This is a fantastic play.
Thank you so much. See you there.
I'm Charles Sipos. It's Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa.
When you try your best but you don't succeed, when you get what you want but not what you need, when you feel so tired but you can't sleep, stuck in rivers, and the tears come streaming down your face.
You've been listening to Curtain Call here on KRCB-FM. Dr. Charles Sipos is a composer and teacher of piano, composition, theory, and music appreciation throughout the North Bay. Information is available at transcend.com. That's TRANSCEND.com. You can hear this episode of Curtain Call again at krcb.org/podcasts.